This is Dr. Charles Parker, and you're listening to Core Brain Journal. It's a place where I connect both fresh discoveries and interesting different perspectives from advanced mind science with the realities of real people and everyday life down on Main Street.
Well, welcome aboard, folks. Dr. Charles Parker here one more time, and we have a very interesting and a very comprehensive view this afternoon. We're going to be joined by Dr. Chris Friesen, and he's going to talk to us about a variety of different things, including how you can plan to become who you want to be, how you can actually measure things with your mind and brain, and how some of those tools that informed practitioners, neuropsychologists do in terms of measurement and actual practical matters. So welcome, Chris. Nice to have you on board.
Thanks, Chuck. Thanks for having me. You have a great show here, so I'm happy to be on the show.
It's good. So what I'm going to do is just say a couple words about the people who are helping us be on today. First of all, a brief word about Direct Health Access. You listeners already know how much we love the reality of data here at CBJ. And today we're welcoming our clinical friend and our new sponsor partner, Direct Health Access Laboratory. With over 3 million studies, they are deep leaders of experience with the big picture of measuring, for example, methylation, cryptopyrrole, and copper challenges. Global service with a molecular focus. Stay tuned. We're looking forward to working with them. And then we also have locally here, you listeners also know that we appreciate detailed improvements of mind care. And we have a local sponsor who is a residential care facility. So this particular group is the nonprofit Barry Robinson Center right here in Norfolk. They have an adolescent and child residential treatment facility that's nationally and internationally recognized. They've been in business only for 80 years. And what they do is they provide residential care on an evolved family and interpersonal level. So they're interpersonal, but global. More about them later. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Chris and we'll get started. Dr. Friesen is a PhD, a C-psych. You need to tell us about what that is. Originally from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and is now located in the Niagara region up there. He is a psychologist who's always been fascinated by what makes people successful. He's a licensed clinical forensic and neuropsychologist, more about that in a minute, and now he helps primarily works with professional, national Olympic, and up-and-coming elite athletes. We're looking forward to hearing about that, as well as other high achievers such as professionals, entrepreneurs, executives, academics, writers, achieve their personal and professional potential. That is a mouthful. He's a busy guy. So he's currently director of the Friesen Sport and Performance Psychology website and a contributor to success.com. We're going to have his connections down in the show notes. You're going to really enjoy. It's been great fun getting ready and seeing what he's doing. He's very, very busy. And he's the author of Achieve, Find Out Who You Are and What You Really Want and How to Make It Happen. Those are very good words. You think about the utilitarian value of that title. It's unbelievable. So, Chris, tell us a little bit about yourself that we haven't covered here. What you're up to, what you're doing, what you really like to do.
Yeah. So, like you said, I'm in the Niagara region in Ontario, Canada. I used to play hockey as a goalie when I was young. I have a soon-to-be 5-year-old daughter. And my wife's also a psychologist who specializes in eating disorders. And I love science fiction. I love biographies. These are sort of the non-clinical or professional aspects of my life. So, and a big part of what I also do is neuropsychology work as well, not always with athletes, with clinical populations. The other website I have is called NiagaraNeuropsychology.com. So that's another big part of what I spend my time doing.
Well, Chris, and as a matter of fact, I saw that. I saw both sites, and I actually hooked you up in the show notes. I've already pre-written the show notes, so, and I hooked up the Niagara Psychology Clinic as well. So
great.
Right on it. So let's get started. I mean, there are a couple of things we could talk about. I think the first thing to do is let's talk about your recent book. Let's talk about people going somewhere, identifying who they are, how they can get there, some of the things that we've really found out that are useful and structurally helpful, as opposed to deep psychotherapy, what's your Oedipus complex like?
Yes. So the book is really a combination of experience I've had with working with high achievers, a little bit of my own life experience, and of course what the research suggests. And it really to find out who you are, what you really want, and how to make it happen. My perception is a lot of self-help books that are out there start too far away. They start to, or too microscopic. They start in the, setting goals. And in my book, setting goals is really near the end. It really starts off getting to know, the first step is getting to know your core personality. These are based on something called the five-factor model, or the big five personality dimensions that, actually the DSM-5 is now using that as a supplementary dimensional model of personality or personality pathology. But this is in personality research. This has been known for at least 70 years now that there are, if you take any measure, MMPI, PAI, any of the personality measures, not the Rorschach, but other measures, when you do some fancy statistics to it called factor analysis, you really come up with five global dimensions of personality, which briefly are susceptibility to negative emotions and stress. That's what I call it. The literature calls it neuroticism. So you can be either high on this or low on this, and it's exactly what it sounds like. Extroversion and introversion. These are, again, a dimensional continuum. And we all know what that means to an extent. Some of the information that's out there in other books is a little bit misleading. Introversion is really more of an absence of extroversion. It doesn't include other things like introspection and that kind of thing, which some books suggest. That's really part of another of the dimensions called openness to experience. The other two are conscientiousness, which I call motivation and self-control, which is basically where someone stands in terms of their motivation and their discipline, that kind of thing, their organizational tendencies. And agreeableness is really an interpersonal attitudinal dimension, which is basically how our attitudes towards others, whether we're sort of competitive, trusting or not trusting, that sort of thing. So I think the very first step, because these have biological underpinnings, about 50%, so 50% of our personality is genetically inherited. We know this from twin studies, twins raised apart, etc. The other 50% is obviously to do with our environment, but we're not very good at measuring exactly in the environment what causes this. So there is biological and neurological underpinnings for these, and they're not easily changed. They're not unchangeable. They're just very difficult to change. And unless it's a major problem for you, you probably don't want to try to change it too much, because it's an uphill battle. To make an introvert an extrovert or an extrovert an introvert is actually quite difficult to do. Unless it's caused by something else. Some people can be introverted because of social anxiety, which is actually not the same as introversion. Introversion is not related to anxiety, which is part of, anxiety is part of negative emotions and stress or neuroticism. These are orthogonal dimensions, which means that they're not correlated. So your standing on one is not related to your standing on another. So long story short, the first thing I believe people need to know is, what is their core personality? What is their biological underpinnings? And then it really comes down to figuring out your values, some of your strengths, and then from there coming up with a mission, like a mission statement, for example. And only then should you start to set goals, long-term goals, short-term goals. And the very last chapter is really about, how do I put this all into action on a day-to-day basis, from understanding willpower to whether you should be using a to-do list. So that's really the book in a nutshell.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff. I got to tell you, we're on the same path. I didn't know this as you really. I didn't have a chance to read the book, so I'm listening to this, and I've always been interested in personality myself, because it's sort of that ne'er-do-well guy hanging out there that nobody can do anything with. It's just a label, and hey, that's what you're going to be with the rest of your life. You got a personality disorder. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Call and you see this in meetings. You know, somebody's talking about, well, hey, you can't do anything with him. They don't say it that way.
Yep.
But they say, well, he's got a personality disorder. And then, of course, the psychoanalyst would jump on that. And I'm a recovering psychoanalyst. I don't know if you knew that. I took seven additional years on that one. So, and in those meetings, you say, well, hey, you know, he's got a touch of resistance going on. You know, he's stuck somewhere back in some past situation that we're just going to have to give him 7 years of analysis. And maybe it'll come out. So what you're saying is there are some really important cognitive things we can do. And to just tell you a little bit more, as I wrote a book back in 92, a long time ago, called Deep Recovery, How to Use Your Most Difficult Relationships to Find Out Who You Are. And I was using the self-awareness from a relationship perspective, you know, faulty relationships that didn't work out that you wanted to work out. That you could say, okay, what were my goals? What did I want from this relationship? How did I contribute to it not working out? What was I doing that was not as effective as it needed to be in this? It's really just increasing self-awareness.
Yes.
And saying, look, personality patterns are correctable. And I really like the introduction you had there about the fact that they're biologically mediated. You know, you're going to enjoy, and I know our listeners will too, going back to listen to Dr. William Walsh on 025, because his whole thing, and when you get deeply into Walsh, a lot of what he talks about all the way down to autism, which of course is not a personality disorder, but goes in the direction of, hey, it's incurable. You know, then you start to look at those biologic underpinnings that can actually have, and I've seen this in my own office, personality attributes that seem like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? Certainly they're beyond medication. So that's really interesting. Now, how do you actually apply these concepts with individuals that you're consulting with? I got the timeline a little bit. Where do you see the most difficulty in the next transition of awareness? Once they say, okay, here's some underpinnings, where do I go with it? Where do you see the resistances and the troubles coming in that next step for the most part?
Well, I think one of the first things to do is really to come to a decision in a way to accept parts of your personality as just the way you are. So there's a bit of a distinction between a personality disorder and where you stand on these, what I'm describing are normal personality dimensions or traits. So we all fall along a continuum of these extreme scores on some of these are highly correlated with personality disorders. But I really think that people need to, let's just say, for example, you are introverted by nature. And this is, you've always been this way. It's not because of anxiety. It's not because you're shy, because you can work on anxiety and overcome that. But if your goals or values or mission is to, you know, spread the word about something across the globe and go and give talks, and you're very introverted, well, it's good to know that about yourself, because you're, you know, susceptible to burnout. If you're, it's really extroversion, introversion really has to do with external stimulation tolerance, whether it's social, whether it's just environmental in the sense of living in a big city in the downtown versus living in the country. So if you know where you stand, and sometimes, and there's a really big push in this in the psychotherapy research, the third wave of behavior therapy, for example, acceptance and commitment therapy, which is getting lots and lots of new data supporting this. And of course, this is related to mindfulness, is acceptance. It's sort of accepting the way you are, and then finding out what your goals and values are, and just working towards that. But if your goal is to really be in front of people, then, you know, maybe you should work on that, and you can work on your introversion to try to be extroverted, but at least knowing that compared to, let's say, someone who's extroverted, you're going to need time to be alone. So if your job all day is meeting and greeting with people, as an introvert, you're going to need to go home and recharge. Vice versa, if you're an extrovert in your job, involves sitting in a library by yourself or doing research for hours on your own, you know, at home, you're going to have to do some exciting, often socially stimulating activities. So I really think accepting parts of you that are really difficult to change, and only changing them if you feel it is necessary. But I really believe that all of these traits have in our society. We don't want a uniculture. I don't believe that everyone should be have no negative emotions and be extroverted and open and agreeable. That's actually not good for society. There's a reason biologically or genetically or evolutionarily why we have all these variations within the population, because they were all adaptive. So just a quick example, someone who's really high on negative emotions, back when we were living, on the savannah as a tribe, those people were very helpful because they could predict, sometimes over-predict, negative things that might happen. You know, they may see someone from another tribe and think this person's dangerous, or we shouldn't take this long trek. What if we run out of food? Whereas the people who had very low anxiety, if everyone was like that, then the tribe would have made a lot of mistakes. And you can make that argument for every one of these dimensions. So they're all adaptive. It's really if it matches your environment. And I really don't think there's a need to change it unless it's really getting in the way of your goals. But there's usually a way around it. The one exception is the negative emotion side. This can really hold people back at times. But this is something that most athletes, for example, come to see me. They say, listen, I want to be, I'm going to the Olympics and I feel really anxious. I don't want to feel anxiety. And maybe they have a personality tendency to experience a lot of negative emotions. And one of the things is to remind them that, of course, you're going to feel nervous at the Olympics. That's expected. That's normal. And also, peak performance actually occurs when you do have anxiety. It doesn't occur when you have no anxiety, and it doesn't occur when you have close to panic anxiety. It's called the Yerkes-Dodson law. This means that peak performance, no matter what situation, whether it's powerlifting or whether it's chess, occurs at a moderate level of arousal. Of course, the curve is pushed to the left or to the right, depending if it's powerlifting or chess. But you actually want some negative emotions. And another example is actors, writers, lots of artists, they tend to have high levels of negative emotions as a personality trait or dimension. And this is good because you need to tap into those feelings to produce art, to be empathetic, to portray a character. So these are all good things, and it's just really accepting that, because our society, our media tends to portray a uniculture of we should all have the same values and have the same personalities, which I think is actually not very healthy for us.
Very well said. I was thinking about several things as you were talking along. I was thinking about, how leadership evolves. I'm not getting into politics by any means, but that's that's kind of where the mind goes when you're talking about who's running the tribe, and then it's hard to not think about it in current times. And then I was thinking about the whole situation of the importance and the relevance in athletic performance of guided imagery. Because in a way, if a person has an anxiety and then they start thinking about the negatives, anxiety can create a negative and can create, altered, inappropriate, falling off the bar, tripping on the run or whatever, as opposed to really being synchronous and going over the bar and really having a sense of coordination and victory, where you actually imagine that you can do that, as opposed to living in the negative mind construct. Do you do affirmations and guided imagery like that as well?
Yes, in a way. One of the best, in my opinion, one of the best types of imagery is something called WOOP, W-O-O-P. And if you go to whoopmylife.org, you can find out more information. I'm not associated with this. This is a psychologist in New York, a researcher who's been studying some of the best ways to achieve goals. And I'll just actually summarize it really quickly. And I would do this with an athlete. So, for example, WOOP stands for wish. So let me go through all the whole acronym. W is for wish, O is for outcome, the other O is for obstacles, and the P is for planning or if-then planning. So what we do is I get the athlete or whoever, a high achiever, to close their eyes, and okay, we come up with the wish. Wish is really just what you want to happen. I want to win this this game. Okay, so you bring that to mind, and then we think of the outcome, which is how great it's going to feel. Then we get into that guided imagery, all this, you know, incorporating all the senses, getting the person to imagine how good it's going to feel, what they're going to hear, what they're going to feel, you know, in their body. What are they doing with their body? What are they seeing? All those things. And we get that to be as vivid as possible. And then we go over obstacles, which is all the things that can go wrong. And I think this is one of the places that a lot of mental skills trainer or sports psychologists go wrong, is that they stick to just the pure positive. But mm-hmm. going over the obstacles, which is, okay, you know, I could be wrestling and feel like I'm getting really tired, or I could be distracted by the crowd. And you go up, come up with all the things that could affect your performance. And then the last thing, P, is planning, or if then planning. So you say to yourself, okay, if I'm noticing that I'm distracted by the crowd, you know, I'm going to slap my hands together to do basically bring my attention back to the present moment. If I'm feeling exhausted, I'm going to imagine, you know, how good it would feel to win, you know, whatever it may be. And research shows that even just the last part, the P, the if-then planning, people are about 300% more likely to achieve a goal just by doing if-then planning. Yeah, so this is my sort of fancy way of doing imagery, but incorporating this just a bit more research into it. One thing, you can think of astronauts, for example. They definitely do whoop, you know, before they go to outer space. Mm-hmm. They go over every single possible mm-hmm. Obstacle and this possible solution. So when you're in the situation and you've already gone over whoop, in other words, every day you're gonna rehearse this, all the things that can happen, whether it's a long-term goal or whether it's, you know, the goal of this podcast, you know, what how you want it to go and what you want to do. But what happens is when you're in a situation where you're stressed or tired, we go back to our old habits. So when you practice whoop, what happens is it automatically, you do the things you plan to do. So it really saves you in a way when things don't go as planned. It becomes automatic. It's not like an astronaut, you know, they're like, oh, I'm too stressed, I can't decide, what do I do? There's a leak in the shuttle. They just know what to do automatically because of whoop.
See, that's very interesting, because what you're bringing in, and I think it's very good that you highlighted that, because that is so true. So, and we've had some really interesting interviews here in Core Brain Journal, and mm-hmm. and some of them do take the direction of affirmation. In fact, mm-hmm. I just read a Wall Street Journal, apropos of what you're talking about, which I had no idea why this was in the Wall Street Journal. And this is going to sound, speaking of whoop, it's going to sound a little woo what I'm about to tell you. But they were really quite firm on the value of mantra affirmations. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, and they were actually spent a lot of time in the Wall Street Journal saying, here is there is a value scientifically proven on a 5-6 word mantra. Like, in these situations, I rise to the occasion or whatever. I'm mm-hmm. just making something up.
Yeah.
But the point is that you have a mindset that deals with a problem.
Yes.
You know, and it's a built-in mindset. And you, when you say that, it takes you into a different, more acceptable reality mm-hmm. in which you're actually coping with the reality that you're dealing with.
And that's interesting, because a lot of people also come to me and say, look, I want to have no doubts. I want to be fully confident and have no doubts in my abilities. And I usually give them a little lecture. I say, listen, let's just pretend I had a magic wand and I could erase that part of you, or I can destroy that part of your brain that gives you any doubts. And let's just see how good of an idea that is. So let's just say the Olympics are 3 months away and your alarm goes off at 5 a.m. to get up and train, but you don't have any doubts anymore. You're pretty convinced you're going to win. How motivated are you going to be to get up and train?
Yeah.
You just say, well, not so motivated, maybe. And I go, okay, how about your training? And you start to get sore and tired. And, you know, how motivated are you going to be to train if you're pretty confident you're going to win? Well, not so motivated.
Your whole aggression's going out the window. It reminds me of Muhammad Ali training for what he was going to say to psych out his combatant before he even got in the ring.
Yes.
He was calling him names and, you know, pimping his mother, whatever. And the guy came in and was just furious, and he was like, relax, because that person hadn't organized that game plan. Mm-hmm. And so he would, you know, sting like a bumblebee, whatever, buzz like a bumblebee, sting like a bee, something like that. But anyway, it was really very interesting because he put the mindset into the preparation for the negative and actually created an adversity situation. Yeah.
Well, and I actually think this is a societal problem. I see it clinically, and I also see it, you know, with high achievers and with just regular Joes. So we live in a time in history where we have nothing but comfort. We don't need to experience extremes in temperature. We have air conditioning. We have furnaces. So we rarely experience any extremes in temperature compared to all of our history. We rarely experience true threats. There may be a lot of anxiety, but true threats are actually quite low relative to when we lived in the savannah or when we lived 100 years ago. There's much more threat of disease, starvation. The economy was not so hot, you know, that kind of thing. We had a lot more real threats. And I really think it's affected us as a society. We're a lot less hardy than we were before. And there's a real push in the subfield of what they call biohacking, which I realize I'm part of, which I didn't realize until a couple of years ago. Someone says, you're a biohacker. I said, oh, okay. But the, I'll just give you an example of a trend. So one trend is to expose yourself to heat and cold. And there's, I'm not a physiologist, but there's research to suggest that being in hot saunas actually does a lot of good things for our bodies, for our psyches. And I personally use a sauna about four mornings a week, but also cold exposure to cold. So, I mean, I wouldn't recommend running around in your underwears in the winter, but, a better way to do this would be using, like I do, for about 2 years now, I've taken nothing but cold showers. And it seems crazy to people, but it really does boost your sense of self-efficacy. Because before you go in that shower, your mind inevitably pops up with thoughts like, this is going to be hell.
Why am I doing this?
Why am I doing this? You're not going to be able to handle this. And it's too early. And you train yourself to be able to not get hooked by these thoughts and say, okay, thanks, mind. I know what you're doing. You're programmed to protect me. But you're like an overprotective mother. Sometimes you're overprotective and you're, false alarming it. And you do it anyways. And this is the key, I think, is doing it despite how you feel. This is the key to success, I believe, in life. And you go in the shower, it feels uncomfortable, it's never as bad as you predicted, and at the end you feel good about it. It's the same thing with exercising. It's the same thing. But we live in such an environment that we're so protected by not only physical pain, but also psychological pain. So when anything goes wrong or we feel any negative emotions, we feel like we need to, we feel bad. We shouldn't have negative emotions because everybody, let's say on Facebook, looks like they're having a great old time and we're not so happy some days and maybe there's something wrong with me. But the reality is we all have these emotions and these are we really have an idea that we need to not feel pain. If we have any physical pain, we take Tylenol or ibuprofen and we mask all these things, including negative emotions. We run to the bottle, to cannabis, to television, to Facebook to not feel pain. And that in the end actually costs us and makes us weaker.
No question about it. Actually, you're again driving at a point that I've always been fascinated by and reflecting on my own life. It's been the painful events in my life which have really driven me forward to whatever next thing is going to happen, because I actually faced that thing and I realized that thing and I've embraced it and I've got to do something else with it. My first book was based on a very painful professional experience with a guy that I had a lot of respect for. It turned inside out. And I was like, okay, this is a difficult relationship. What am I going to make out of this thing? What can I do to understand it better? And it really pushed me down a lot of different avenues. It's a very useful point. Now, I got to take a quick break here. This is a great conversation. I can see I'm looking forward to talking more with you. And one of the things we have to do is take a break for our sponsors. We come back. I want to talk with you and take some time to talk about some of these other, for want of a better expression, neurodiversity tools. I mean, we've talked about jumping in a cold shower. We talked about the value of hot showers. hot sauce, pardon me. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about where I'm going. And the next thing, of course, is let's talk about those tools to measure these things that you know something about being a neuropsychologist. So we'll be back, folks, in just a minute.
Well, folks, you know as well as I do that psychiatric treatment failure, especially after multiple medication trials and those very, very brief hospitalizations, may prove insufficient to deal at home with the complexity of troubled children and those adolescents from 6 to 17 years old. Improved care, those next mandatory steps, should include a more comprehensive approach to address those multiple levels of challenges, from family to peers to school, diagnostically from defiance to depression, on every level for families, including military families internationally. The Barry Robinson Center's 32-acre open college-like campus in Norfolk, Virginia, provides safety and security and clean, comfortable living. How do we know? We refer folks over there all the time, strongly endorse what they're doing. So for further information and informed interview, connect at this page, barryrobinson.org/core.
Well, you folks already know that here at Core Brain Journal, we're on a mission to introduce you to resources that make significant contributions to the investigation of those predictable mind science applications. Our colleagues at DHA Lab Group provide a real difference with treatment options for people at every level, from first awareness of mind problems to those frustrating times when even well-informed treatment becomes surprisingly unpredictable. For my entire professional life, from psychoanalysis to brain scans, I've searched for, yes, improved predictability. The good news for all of us, from professionals to patients, remarkably effective research offers useful, cost-effective, organic options far beyond guesswork with psychiatric medications alone. DHA lab tests measure unbalanced biomedical details through easily available testing, now available globally for a variety of molecular answers from, for example, methylation, copper, and cryptopyrrole challenges. Check in for more details at dhalab.com core. That's dhalab.com/core. Okay, guys, welcome back. We had a little break there. Thanks for our sponsors. Now we're going to go back to talk to Chris and really hit this whole thing of what Dr. Friesen thinks is our tools that can actually help us measure some of these. And we haven't spent a lot of time at Core Brain Journal talking about tools. Yes, we've talked about laboratory tools. One of our sponsors is a laboratory. But going over into the other tools that neuropsychologists and others can use to measure and actually directly treat the brain, it's a deeper subject. We're not going to be able to cover it in the rest of this interview. But let's touch a little bit on it, Chris, in terms of what you do as a professional, what you think has been valuable for you and people that you've worked with.
Yes. So one of the things I have board certification in neurofeedback, which is a form of biofeedback that is really training brainwaves, for lack of a better, for a simple way of explaining it. And one of the things we do, ideally, it's expensive to get into it, but ideally is to do a quantitative EEG or electroencephalograph before you start the training. And QEEGs are similar to the same basic equipment as a neurologist or a sleep specialist would use, except the neurologist and sleep specialist is looking at the same waveforms, but they don't convert it to a normative database, which is a very psychology type thing to do. We psychologists, because we have PhDs, we like to turn things into data and normative data. Because, you know, what does it mean if you score 10 out of 20? Does that mean you're better than most people or worse than most people? And so this is why we need normative data to compare ourselves to others our age. So quantitative EEG takes the regular EEG and basically puts it into a database and converts it to normative measures. They're called Z-scores. And this is just how much deviation your parts of your brain, how much they're deviating from a normative sample of usually highly what we call clean individuals. So individuals with no history of anything. So it's debatable whether they're normal or not, because they're ultra clean. They have no history of any, never taken any antidepressants, you know, no mental health history, no diseases, you know, that kind of thing. Intelligence has to be about average, which by definition, therefore, it's missing chunks of the population. But so what we do is you can do a quantitative EEG. It takes about an hour to do, like, start to finish. You put a cap on. You know, you put these electrodes on 19 sites, and you just sit there, close your eyes for a few minutes, and open your eyes for a few minutes, and that's typically it. You don't feel anything because it's just measuring electricity that's produced by your brain. And then we get these things called brain maps, which shows us if there's any areas of overactivity or underactivity. And there's a whole bunch of metrics, pages and pages, but to simplify it, there's metrics of how parts of the brain are communicating with each other, etc. And so what we can do is look at that and see if there's areas that correspond with symptoms. And I'll give you a quick example. I worked with a very high-level athlete who had problems not only in sport but also in their personal life with anxiety. But on the QEEG, they had a lot of excessive fast wave activity in the parietal lobes. And this individual's sport involved basically a lot of spatial awareness in the parietal lobes, especially the right side, you know, controls that. And so it's kind of interesting. It makes, you know, I had to step back and wonder, well, do I want to train this down with neurofeedback? But I could, which would probably reduce the anxiety, but it also may affect their visual spatial abilities. They may not be one of the best in the world anymore. So it can be a little bit of a dangerous thing in terms of someone's career. And so I really think that people who do neurofeedback and quantitative EEG need a lot of training, preferably a registered health professional like a neuropsychologist, psychiatrist, neurologist, who have a lot of training in the brain, because you can do some damage if you train the wrong things. I'll stop there, but there's a lot more I can say, but I'll let you ask any more questions.
Well, you piqued my interest. I'm sure everybody there is waiting with bated breath. What happened to the guy? What did you do? What was your resolution to that problem?
Well, actually, interestingly enough, this actually just happened about 2 weeks.
So you're not there yet.
We're not there yet. That's right. What I did was consulted with one of the top experts in sports psychology, neuropsychology, and quantitative EEG and neurofeedback named Leslie Sherlin. He's in California. I contacted him. And actually, as we speak, he's actually reviewing this. I said, look, I want to make sure I don't make a mistake. And he's seen thousands and thousands and thousands of high achieving athletes, their QEEG brain maps. And like most people, we it's always good to have a second opinion before you tinker with something like that. And so I'm actually waiting to hear back too. I think that we're not going to train it down. We're going to train it in a different way. And this is the thing, when you get a quantitative EEG, pretty much everyone will show abnormalities. It's like giving someone a personality measure. You know, everyone doesn't score average on every dimension. People are going to have things, you know, dimensions that are high, some that are low, some that are average. That's the same thing that happens when you do a quantitative EEG, and we have to be careful not to over-pathologize any findings. I'll give you a quick example. My posterior cingulate is, you know, has a lot of beta, high beta activity, which is fast activity. That was really the only abnormality, I guess you could say, on mine. But the question was, is this part of what makes me unique, that drives me, that makes me think quickly, that, you know, or is this, you know, a pathological thing? But the reality is I had no symptoms that corresponded with that area. And so if there's no symptoms corresponding with the abnormalities on the brain map, we don't touch them.
Well, that's interesting. Now, let me tell you, I know just a little bit compared to you about the posterior cingulate. Okay, so so what happens with the anterior cingulate is stuck on obsessional thinking. It doesn't necessarily have to have anxiety associated with it, but it's locked down in a certain respect. The good thing about having a nice, hot posterior cingulate is you definitely don't have Alzheimer's. It's one of the first things to go. You know, when you look at a scan and that posterior cingulate is out, then and you have some other signs, it's like, okay, maybe we're over in an unpleasant place. So, but one of the things that I learned that we've seen and with the people we've worked with is it is a place for memories that are in some level conflictual, perhaps, but are and maybe not entirely resolved. Now, I'm not doing psychoanalysis with you. I'm just telling you. It's, you know, something to think about because it may not show as a cortical expression. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how deep those EEG goes, those QEGs actually go, you know, whether they show mainly cortex because you're looking at the surface.
They do. And they go down to the, they go down between the hemispheres. You can get at the hippocampus to some extent as well.
Is that right?
But not really the subcortical regions, brainstem. You don't get that. It's really cortex. You have to do something called Loretta, which is a 3D map that isn't perfect, but it's quite good. It can really pinpoint where is this, you know, emanating from. Where is this fast activity? Because if you just do a 2D map, it just shows it. It's near the top back of the head. But once you do the Loretta analysis, you can actually look at where is it coming from. Is it posterior cingulate, or is it actually on the surface? So is it on the on the parietal lobe? Where is it coming from? So, I really believe the future of psychiatry, clinical psychology, neuropsychology is neuromodulation. Yeah, I don't, and when totally. I say that, I don't mean that psychotherapy is going to go to the wayside. Psychotherapy will always be extremely important. I think that the neuromodulation is going to be either equal to pharmaceuticals in the sense of how frequently they are used and how accessible they are. But I think all three have a very strong role. They attack the brain in a way at different levels. And I think we're in a really exciting time right now when it comes to especially individuals with clinical difficulties. The neuromodulation, for example, neurofeedback, is really changing the game, I believe.
Well, let's take just a minute because I'm sure a number of people are, I know some of these answers, of course, but I want you to elaborate on them. Mm-hmm. Number one is when you put that cap on and you got the electrodes in, they're not sticking needles in your skin.
No.
There are electrodes on the surface.
That's right. We do use a blunt needle. So you'll see somebody's a picture. It looks like someone's sticking a needle into someone's head. They're just squirting the gel, the conductive solution, into the little holes. So no, there's no needles to the head. It's like a swim cap with a bunch of holes in it. But the biggest side effect is you get some goo in your hair when you're done.
Yeah. And the next point is, I think it'd be good if you could just take a moment to explain what actually happens with neurofeedback. You know, with biofeedback, it can be breathing and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. With neurofeedback, tell our listeners what actually happens and how you actually, like, for example, with that athlete that you're talking about, if you're going to bring some of that down a little bit, how do you actually do that? Well, how does that tool actually work?
Sure. So the quantitative EEG gives us a map to start with. So we don't just train everyone the same, because you can, you know, train up alpha, which is sort of a relaxation, meditative type state. But if someone has excessive alpha, that's actually not good. Alpha is part when your brain is actually in idling mode, it's actually not really doing anything. It's good at times, but not all the time. So neurofeedback, so if we find an abnormality, let's just say, for example, attention deficit disorder, the majority tend to have excessive slow wave activity, which is usually theta or alpha, in the frontal lobes. And essentially, this represents an underactivation or hypoperfusion, that kind of thing. And so the training, so if you find that on a QEEG and the person does describe you having ADHD symptoms and they're diagnosed with that, we can train that up. So they look at a screen. We don't do the full cap anymore. We may just use 1 to 4 electrodes, you call them sensors, that stick to your scalp. And you basically play a video game or watch a movie, and the movie or the game doesn't go forward unless your brain's in the correct state. So in this circumstance, would be to reduce the amount of slow wave activity, which, you know, correspondingly increases the activity of that part of the brain. It's sort of a double negative, but we reduce inhibit slow wave activity. It speeds up that activity in the front part of the brain. So it's a form of, it's based on neuroplasticity. So you need to do something again and again, usually twice a week for a minimum of about 20 sessions to get any improvement. So you can compare it to a physical exercise program where if you worked out once or twice, it's not going to really do anything. You got to work out a couple days a week for, you know, a few months. 3 months to get an effect. And the difference, though, with working out is with the neurofeedback, you're basically putting your brain into states that it doesn't normally go into. So when we're measuring the QEEG, they're at rest and their brain is just not producing a lot of activity, or the opposite, they're too much fast activity. And this is what it's doing. And so what we're doing is, it's as if with ADHD with slow wave activity, it's as if there is a brick underneath the gas pedal. And what we're doing is slowly chipping away at that brick to make it smaller and smaller. So the gas pedal can now go all the way down and all the way up. So it's really building mental flexibility. So when the situation calls for it, for example, you're in school, listening to a teacher, or you're at your job where you have to study some boring material, you can make your brain focus. In other words, decrease the theta activity at will. And so this is really what happens. And a lot of the time, if you do a post-test quantitative EEG, you'll see that the slow wave activity is actually decreased. So that's good. Sometimes there's not much of a difference, but there's a behavioral difference because now the person has flexibility. They can kind of turn it on and off at will. So that's sort of the best way to explain it, I think.
And so the training, let's take a little more and get a little more of a magnifying glass out so listeners who don't know what neurofeedback is. I mean, there are a lot of people here that know exactly what it is, but I think just to embrace the entire audience a little bit, The my experience with neurofeedback is you're actually watching a monitor, a screen, and you see that screen and there are activities on the screen that are in fact doing different things that are related to the pickups on your brain that translate it to the feed. So the picture itself is modified by what you're actually doing with your brain waves. And on some levels, you actually try to guide that screen around, not by touching anything, but by actually thinking about things in different ways.
Yes, yes. And there's some debate in the field about how much of it is conscious and how much of it is not conscious, in the sense of sometimes the harder you try, let's say you have a lot of high beta activity, so in other words, parts of your brain are overactivated. The harder you try to make, let's say, the car move in the video game, so the car won't move if the beta is high. It will move only when you reduce that activity. So the harder you try, the higher the beta goes, the more the car doesn't move. And so you really have to let go and allow the car to move. So a lot of people will say, and I tend to agree with this to a certain extent, is that you don't even have to want to improve. You look at the screen, your brain wants the car to move or wants the movie to continue to play and not pause, or the volume to stay up and not, you know, go into mute, or the screen to fade or not fade. Your brain wants that even beyond a conscious level. It's just a more pleasurable experience. So it's going to learn on its own without conscious awareness to do that. So that's one really neat thing about neurofeedback is some individuals, they don't want to do psychotherapy, for example. So if people with depression or anxiety, and neurofeedback is a good alternative option. I don't think it fully replaces psychotherapy, but I do think for some individuals, it is a great option. So it's interesting how it works, and it's still an evolving field.
Chris, thank you so much. You know, we haven't really touched the surface in a conversation we need to have. There were some other tools that came up. There are some other things. I mean, as a little bit of a tease, we're going to have you back with your permission, of course. I would like to talk about some of those other tools. And I think what you do with athletes, what you do with entrepreneurs who are stuck, that's very, very interesting, because so many of us, myself included, have been stuck in our lives trying to find some answers of where do we go, what do we do, and thanks that we have professionals like yourself who can say, look, you don't have to be stuck anymore. In fact, a good buddy of mine, Tom Brown at Yale, wrote a book that was really basically on brain stuckness as a measure of attention deficit disorder. Actually, the new phrase is executive function disorder. I mean, people, ADHD is an appearance term, and it's really kind of outdated. And he's written a book about, you know, being stuck. So with that, Chris, what we're going to do is tease them. Let's say a couple things about some of these other topics that we may get into in the future. I haven't prepared you for this. So, you know, let's go back to that talk we had a little bit, if you don't mind, and say a couple words, and then we'll wind it up.
Yeah. I mean, other neuromodulation strategies.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of interesting things out there. I'll just briefly touch upon them. One is cranial electrotherapy stimulation, or CES. There's a device called AlphaStim. In the United States, you need a prescription. In Canada, you don't. This has been shown to be helpful with anxiety, depression, and insomnia. Transcranial direct current stimulation, or TDCS, is very rarely used clinically. It's got a lot of research, especially with depression. The newest thing is transcranial photobiomodulation, which is using infrared light. You wear a little helmet thing. Infrared light goes up your nose to get to the prefrontal cortex, and you wear a little cap on your head, and this affects the mitochondria. And preliminary work that's happening is suggesting very strong responses to individuals with dementia, for example, full-blown Alzheimer's disease, etc. Research is showing that it's helpful as you're using it, but if you stop using it, the effects start to wear off. But this is these are just a couple of examples of other neuromodulation strategies that I think are going to get more and more research,
attention.
Yeah, and people are going to start looking for these to help themselves.
Well, that last one is very interesting because I have a friend up in D.C. who does near infrared hemoencephalography.
Oh, yes.
Blows a near infrared beam right through the skin and through the cranium and has some very positive effects. So we can talk about all this, and I look very much forward to having you back, Dr. Chris Friesen. And by the way, let's close with where people can reach you. We're going to have it on the show notes, but where people can reach you and talk about, we're going to have the book Achieve available as a download possibility. It's not a download, but it would be a drawing possibility. It'll be open for 2 weeks from the time this is published. Thank you very much, Chris, for offering that up. So tell us where we can reach you.
The best place is friesenperformance.com. I have a newsletter there. I post things on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Twitter is at friesenperform. Most of those, they're a combination of brain things, but a lot of the performance side. NiagaraNeuropsychology.com is my more clinical site. That a lot of the stuff we're talking about, I have information there. I have links to various studies and summary research. That'd be a great place to look if you're interested in that. So those are the best places to catch me.
Thank you so much for taking the time. What an interesting conversation. You know, talking with a guy like you gives a lot of people a lot more hope because, hey, there are some things we can do. This is not just imagination. You're talking from brain biology and a really fresh, new, engaging reality. Thank you so much, Chris. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Core Brain Journal. We're working every day behind the scenes to bring you reports that connect research benches with those street trenches. Here we share the complexity of mind science because, as you know, details really do matter. One of the most pervasive, misunderstood challenges is how commonplace medications, like those written for ADHD, are used so regularly without clear guidelines. If you think you'd like more specifics, take a minute to download my 2-page PDF packed with video links and references on the absolute essentials of how to start ADHD medications. They're easily available at corebrainjournal.com/start. Thanks for listening. Do connect and stay tuned. Together we can make a difference.